From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable. It's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Midnight Movie Cowboys. This week, I'm your host, Hunter Dusing, and with me once again is Mr. John Grace. Say hello, John.
Hey! Hey, everybody.
No Stuart. Yeah, no Stuart again this week. But speaking of Australians, we have a topic. We're going to do the sequel to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, the creatively titled Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Sword of Destiny. I don't know what that was, sort of, whatever the Sword of Destiny means. I don't know. But
you're destined to have this sword.
Yeah, the sword. John, do you hold the sword, or does the sword hold you?
Yeah.
Deep.
Yeah, it's what is the riddle of steel, Conan?
Yeah. Anyway, but speaking of Australians, one of the bands we've covered on Rock Month is AC/DC, and recently, by the time this posts, we may have some news on this. So this may be old by the time you hear it.
Right.
But Brian Johnson out of AC/DC, at least for now, because he has hearing damage from racing cars, and he will go deaf completely.
Of all things.
Yeah, I know. Not from playing in the loudest band in the goddamn world.
Right. Not from playing Hell's Bells night after night with a gigantic bell.
Or singing for those about to rock with a cannon going off.
Right. It's frigging cars.
It's cars, yes. But,
I want to add to that. It does make sense, though, because the truth is, like, when people lose hearing, it's not because they played their Walkmans too loud.
No.
It's usually a sort of genetic thing.
Yeah.
Because I had a grandfather that went deaf, and he never owned headphones, never owned Walkman, didn't even listen to music, really.
Well, that's, my dad has that problem.
Yeah.
My dad experienced hearing loss pretty early on.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, bumping the mic there, sorry. He said, at first, my dad thought it was because he hunted a lot and shot a lot of guns, you know? And you kind of thought, okay, maybe. But then when he got a little older, he said the doctor told him that he was probably born with hearing loss. Like, and that it's been a progressive thing. He wears hearing aids now. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it wasn't like, oh, my dad blared the car stereo and shot guns and stuff. He was like, it probably wasn't from the guns. You know, it was from.
Right.
You know.
Didn't listen to Led Zeppelin 2.
Yeah.
Gigantic old wooden headphones in 1971. All the time.
Right. And I'm sure that stuff like degrades your hearing a little bit, but I don't think anybody's gone deaf from rock and roll, you know? Like,
yeah, maybe Lemmy, but he's not around to ask.
Yeah.
I wouldn't trust his answer anyway. So. Yeah.
Oh, Little Richard, did you know he was gay in the 50s in Alabama?
You know how brave that is. They could have lynched him.
I've seen him say that in like 50 documentaries.
The heaviest rock band I ever saw was the Beatles. If you ever saw them, they were so heavy.
They were the Hard Men, not the Rolling Stones.
It's like, oh, he was gay. He's guy in Alabama. So they could have hung him.
There was some interview where it's like, okay, gosh, Lemmy, Jesus. You know,
going into Afghanistan and Iraq, you've got your new Vietnam. I read a lot of military history, so I can make that judgment.
I did a whole album about World War One. You know.
So Brian Johnson, AC/DC is going to continue without Brian Johnson. Now, Phil Rudd's gone. He's gone nuts. He's threatening hookers and pimps and, you know, all that stuff. He's under house arrest. Malcolm Young has dementia. Or is he dead? I don't know.
Forget.
Malcolm Young. Well, regardless, never going to be in the band again. All you have left is Angus, right?
Pretty much.
Without Brian Johnson. No, right. Malcolm Young's still alive. He's, you know, never mind. I probably saw one of those death hoax things. So, I mean, there's some, like, was it the guy from The Hives said that he would step in? Like, he was kind of...
Oh, really?
Yeah, he was pushing a social media campaign. And I was like, that sounds fucking cool.
Yeah, I don't know if the fans would take it.
Oh, but they would hate it. Like, every story. I was going to say, like, the fans would never accept him. I think it would be awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Because he has that kind of Bon Scott swagger, you know?
Right.
Like, he's old school rock and roll. I like him.
Right.
I like the Hives quite a bit.
Yeah, I love the Hives. Really good band.
They, you know, those guys, I had a friend down in Memphis who made these kind of a few trashy trauma movies and some independent stuff, Mike McCarthy. And he was at a film festival in, like, Mississippi. And
I've never heard of such a thing. I know, but I'm from there.
Yeah, I know. Like in Tupelo or something. Like he was, or he was somewhere. I don't know. And
is he the one that did Teenage Tupelo or whatever the hell?
Yes, yes, that's
like
him.
There was some girl. She was pretty hot looking like 20 years ago. Delana Tunnel.
Yes, she was in several of his movies.
I saw at least one of them. I think I was able to rent it at a store near the campus of Ole Miss in Oxford, Mississippi.
He's kind of a regional like guy. Like he's kind of known down in your old stomping grounds. Like he's from Tupelo.
Right, right.
He was like at a film festival and Pele Almquist, the singer from the Hives, was waiting outside the theater and was like, "Excuse me, Mike McCarthy. I am Pele from the Hives. I want you to direct our music video."
Really?
Yeah,
wow.
He sought him out in person and he got Mike McCarthy to do two music videos for him, one for Abracadaver, and there's two videos for Little More for Little You, both off Tyrannosaurus Hives, and he did this one that's in Memphis where they're running around Beale Street and stuff, but yeah, I thought that was pretty funny though. It was like the Hives just like sought you out in person. He was like, I had no idea who they were.
Because I think Mike McCarthy, directed a Guitar Wolf video, right?
He did, yeah.
Okay.
He put them in his movie, The Sore Losers.
Oh, right, okay. Because I remember there was a compilation of Guitar Wolf videos I saw somewhere, and I noticed Delana Tunnel was in it, and I think it said directed by Mike McCarthy. I was like, oh, this must have been shot in Memphis. Or
yeah, he did one where it had like a Guitar King Ghidra monster.
Right,
and it was pretty. He was very proud of that.
He
always posts pictures of him and his son playing with Godzilla toys. So
okay, he should be.
He's
proud.
Raising him right.
Right, yes, he is.
His son, John Marvel. he's like molding his children into like rock stars. Like his daughter is a singer named Hannah Starr, and she writes music, and she's very talented. But
I should add that was actually pretty far away from where I was growing.
Oh.
So,
oh well,
of it.
Yeah, you know,
yeah. So, I didn't know there's any rock scene. I was like one of the only kids in my hometown who like listened to the Ramones.
Right.
Nobody listened to rock music. They just listened to what girls liked.
We became friends because you know you met somebody who listened to the Stooges.
Everybody was listening to Stooges.
You
and
gotta.
Stuff.
It's like, well, you know, you gotta be friends with them.
Yeah. Right. Right. And it's like. Yeah, you know, everybody in my hometown was like guys, like tough rednecks who were probably going to spend the rest of their lives working at the paper mill or something or driving trucks. Were like, man, Milli Vanilli's good.
No.
Yes. Did I ever tell you about this incident? Oh, you'll love this story. In the 80s, it was very common for heavy metal bands to do their talking to the audience routine.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And they would always rip on the music that they knew the young guys who dug them hated.
Yeah, of course.
Like, Y&T had this routine. It was like, I'm getting so sick, turn on MTV and seeing this Wham! In Culture Club! And everybody's like, ugh, you know. We need rail rock bands like
AC/DC. Fuck those fags!
Right, exactly! And it's like, it just starts the whole fag thing, you know, the fag chants. And then it'd be like, we need real rock bands like AC/DC and, you know, Judas Priest and Motorhead! And everybody's like, you know, yeah! You know, that's what all those meatheads like. So Skid Row is playing. And I don't know if they're opening. They might have been opening for a band, or they may have been headlining. And I guess Sebastian Bach went on some routine, really tired of turning on the radio and hearing Milli fucking Vanilli. And so, I know this one hick from my town was like yelling, "Fuck you, you hood motherfuckers!" Fuck their music. So, because apparently Sebastian Bach, being from Canada, did not realize that the mainstream is very fused in those small towns in Mississippi. So you don't really have that Socs versus the Greasers type thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like the city.
It's real, real, you know, people will go to a Coliseum to see Jimmy Buffett because they were excited that there's a concert in the state that they can go to. The live music, all right, and everybody goes. It's not because they have a choice. They don't have a choice. Like when you're living in Boston or Denver, you have a choice.
Yeah.
You know, you could decide who the hell you want to see.
Like, it's ridiculous how many shows are in Dallas, you know?
One night in Boston, I went to see Johnny Cash, and this was in 1996. And then I just took the train down the street and then saw the Dance Hall Crashers, who were playing a later show.
Wow.
I mean, so it was like two concerts in one night. And Boston is still, I think, really the only city that I could do that. Or even in Denver, the shows kind of happen at the same time.
Yeah, in Dallas, it's that way. It's like, unless it's like a festival or something where they have stuff during the day.
Yeah.
It's like doors at 7, show at 8. You know,
right. But that whole idea, you know, if you live in, I'm sure plenty of our listeners live in these areas. It's like, and I don't think much has changed. It's like, yeah, you just go see Journey's coming to town at their Filipino Steve Perry clone. All right. It's a night out. You know, it's like I can go see some live music.
Yeah.
I know their songs from the radio and they go see them, you know?
Yeah. But so, I don't know. Do you think it's time for AC/DC to kind of pack it in, though?
I think they should. I don't think that crowd will accept a different singer unless they want to do a small circuit and say AC/DC with Jim Dandy or whoever.
Jim Dandy. Yeah, like, but it's got to be like. I mean, I think Angus just needs to do a solo thing and get a different singer. And
the thing is, they've made so much goddamn money.
It's just that the AC/DC brand is so goddamn valuable. You know,
I know, but it's like, you know, it's okay to call it quits. I don't, you know, it's just let.
I mean, I was looking at the videos for the Rock or Bust record, and Angus at this point, like, we're past the expiration date on the schoolboy outfit. Like,
yeah,
it's time to hang it up.
Right.
You know?
Just like we're past the expiration date on Ted Nugent singing Girl Scout cookies.
We're past the expiration date for a lot of Ted's songs.
It's like a lot of that stuff I don't want to ever hear.
Yeah.
It should be coming out of his mouth.
A little less dangerous. Yeah.
It's just like I don't want Iggy Pop to sing Dog Food.
Oh, God. Yeah, that song's creepy.
My girlfriend Betsy, she's just 13, and it's like, oh. And apparently he did have a girlfriend named Betsy who was just 13.
Oh, I'm sure he did. Mm-hmm. Iggy Pop is, he's a guy, like, another thing, past the expiration date on the shirt being off.
Oh, God.
Like, I see these pictures, because he has this album coming out, which I am excited about, with Josh Homme, the post-pop depression thing.
Right.
And, but, like, I see all these articles that are like, David, you know, now that everybody's gone, like, Iggy Pop is rock's greatest, you know, icon. And I see this picture of him with his shirt off, and I'm like, fuck! He looks like he's been left out in the sun.
Yeah, he's got to stop it. His expiration is around 1998, and he should quit.
No, I mean, I listened to old episodes of Loveline from the late 90s where Corolla's making fun of it, you know?
Yeah, it's just like, come on, you're old. Yeah.
But
I remember, like, when Iggy broke his arm in, like, Huntsville, Alabama, doing that tobacco sponsored alternative music tour that I saw him on. He dislocated his shoulder stage diving. In Alabama, they have no idea what that is. And so the seas parted like Moses.
Oh, yeah.
And Iggy landed on the ground and dislocated his shoulder. And they were reading it on Howard Stern's show. And then Howard's like, somebody needs to tell Iggy that he's 50. The irony is, I think he was like 58 or something at the time.
Yeah, and that was how long ago?
Yeah, God, that was like 20 years ago. I mean, he might have been 50, but he's too old to be doing that shit. Oh. And, you know, I've seen him in the 90s. I saw him live in the 90s many times and saw him, the Stooges, last time they came through here. It's like you can see the muscle deterioration, you know, where the muscle mass does not preserve.
Right,
like,
no, it's...
I mean, he landed on me in 1996, so I could say, the muscle mass not preserving there.
Either. Yeah.
Not time to knock it off. And he should have quit stage diving even in the 90s.
You know, but I don't know, man. It's just when your band is... AC/DC's just been slowly falling apart recently, and it's like...
Yeah, it's just like, why keep it going?
Yeah. I mean, you know, and apparently Brian Johnson's been wanting to quit for a while, so I think he's done.
Yeah, he's done.
He said that the only reason he keeps doing it is because Angus keeps, you know, yanking him out. Like,
yeah, and I'm sure they make so much damn money.
Because he's like 10 years older than they are, I think.
Apparently, Brian Johnson has a house in my state.
Oh, really?
Because I went to see a show in Fort Collins at the Budweiser Event Center, and there was Cheap Trick and opening for Alice Cooper.
Mm.
And good Cheap Trick did a lot of talking to the audience, and Rick Nielsen had pointed out that Brian Johnson's wife was in the audience.
Hmm.
And she was like this middle-aged blonde, you know, you could tell she was Australian, you know, or she was married to an Australian at least, because very tan. And then she was just like, you know, I guess Brian was on tour and she was coming out to see Cheap Trick. And he goes, hey, Brian Johnson's wife is in the audience, AC/DC. Barely, they have a house somewhere. I don't know if they have a home in the Rocky Mountains, but a lot of rich rock stars.
Well, it's nice that he's not married to like a, you know, a 20-year-old.
Right.
Like, what was it? Like, you know, Motley Crue recently retired. You know, Nikki Sixx and Tommy Lee are going to have another expensive divorce. You can count on it. They have young wives.
Oh, no. Well, those guys were always boneheads.
Oh, I know. Motley Crue, like, Too Fast for Love is awesome. After that, it gets pretty stupid.
That's what everybody tells me, but I can't listen to them. I just can't stand them. They're part of the, to me, that I was too old for them when they came out, and I was only 12 when they were big. You know? And I've said, oh, this is heavy metal for 7-year-olds.
Yeah. They're not a band I've ever been like a big fan of.
And there are so many people that I've met who love them.
Like, there's people that's like, band. They love, like, you know, I meet people in small town Texas that they're like, oh, yeah, Motley Crue's the best, man.
Same here. I even met Guidos in Boston. We're like, the crew was awesome. They're the best. Crew, you know, it's just blues music is what it is, but it's metal. And they all sound like Florentine, except with the Boston twist.
Hey, you know, it's metal.
Yeah, wow. it's metal, you know.
I love the Crow. Like,
you know, and then Ozzy. Like, no.
Ozzy bit the head off a bat. He's the devil.
Yeah. All these cliches and old stories and urban legends I've been hearing for like 30 years.
Right.
You know, it's like, did you know Ozzy bit a head off a bat or whatever?
Yes.
Did you know someone killed themselves after listening to Judas Priest?
Oh, yeah. Did you see that documentary?
No, I haven't seen it.
They interviewed the kid who shot himself listening to Judas Priest. And, you know, he looks like Arseface. He was the inspiration for Arseface from Preacher.
Uh-huh.
And you watch this documentary and you go, I know why this kid shot himself. It's not because of Judas Priest. It's because his mom is fucking horrifying. Like, she's one of these, like, really, she's like your stereotypical obnoxious Christian lady, like,
right,
who just wants to dominate, like, her son's life. And he was just like, oh, the music made me do it. I don't know why I gave him an English accent.
Is this on Netflix?
I don't know. It's called Dreamer Deceivers.
Oh, okay.
I saw it somewhere streaming, but I don't know. It recently got another DVD release, but so it's probably out there somewhere. Somebody's making money.
And let me guess, the kid had no idea whatsoever that what Rob Halford was really singing about was drinking jizz.
Oh, yeah. I think this documentary it's probably all happened before he came out of the closet, because this was before he left Priest the first time.
But it was like we all knew.
Yeah. He dressed in the gay leather bar outfit.
It was obvious to me. Like, when I was a kid, I was like, there's something wrong. You know, something not right about him. He's not playing for the ladies, you know?
Yeah.
And then when the Police Academy movies came out with the Blue Oyster Bar scenes, I was like, hey, they're dressed up like Rob Halford and Judas Priest.
Hey, why is everybody in Cruising dressed like Rob Halford?
Yeah, it's like... So, it was just kind of known. I don't know why it was shocking them. And, of course, when it happened, I don't think anybody was really stunned.
Yeah, a lot of people say they were, but I think they're just, you know, trying to, you know, we had no idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do believe a lot of people didn't realize the Village People were gay.
Well, yeah, and that was
gay culture just wasn't known.
Yeah, that was before that it went mainstream.
Right.
You know?
And it's like, yeah, I was telling people tonight, they were gay. What? You know, I was just like, yeah, come on. It's like, don't you know? Those are Village stereotypes. What?
Yeah.
You know, people just didn't know that stuff.
Yeah, they didn't know YMCA is about dudes fucking each other. Hang out with boys. They're not hanging out drinking beer. They're hanging out drinking each other's cum.
And it didn't help that the YMCA actually, I think, licensed the song for their ads.
Of course they did.
And so in the Navy, the same thing.
In licensed the Navy. Song. Like, it's about sailors fucking each other.
It's like somebody once said, oh, they were more punk rock than the Sex Pistols because it takes such guts to be in front of thousands of people at a football game and play those songs. No, of those
nobody,
people knew they were gay. They
had any fucking idea, and they knew it. No, but the was it didn't the Village People put out a punk record at one point?
Yeah, they did in like '83. Because I saw it in Cutout Bins, and I remember my cousin, who was a bit of a record collector, was like, "Hey, it's the Village People's punk album." Yeah. I was like, "What?"
And even the cover has a new wavy look to it.
Right. And even by that time, punk rock was dead in like 1984. Yeah. It just didn't exist. It was just those were villains on chips, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's like as we said on our music shows, that the Ramones, the worst thing that ever happened to them was they were called punk rock.
Yeah, I don't think of that New York quote unquote proto punk as punk. Like the Dictators aren't really a punk band.
No.
They're just a sped-up rock and roll band, you know, and the first couple records are, like, almost pop rock albums.
Yeah.
You know, like, I thought the 90s, you know, I thought that the 90s punk stuff was more of an extension of that than the New York, than the hardcore stuff. Like, the hardcore stuff felt more like the British punk and stuff.
It was like they were trying to be Motorhead.
Right. I mean,
and,
it was...
Yeah, Agnostic Front and that sort of stuff. Yeah. Early... 70s punk is what, like, New York punk was real, real punk, but the problem is, stylistically, you listen to it now, and it doesn't sound like punk at all.
No, it does, like, you know, it's completely different, and I love what Jim Goad said, we still can't get over punk. But
Right, and yeah, we're so removed from it.
Yeah.
That was so long ago, mm-hmm. and it's just like, and we still act like we can't get over it.
But
whatever.
Well, it's just there's been nothing new in rock music for a while. Like, yeah, that's caught on culturally.
It is dead.
It's a niche underground thing now.
Yeah, it is. It's like Gene Simmons says the truth, and everybody just hates on him because they want to hate on Gene Simmons.
Well, and all the thing is it's all niche now, and you know that's fine. But like, I don't know. You talk to kids and. I have one student who admits to listening to rock music, and he admitted it when nobody was around. Started talking about music for a second, and I was like, you know, but I was like, oh, he's admitting this because, you know.
Yeah, it's sad, but, you know, whatever. It's like, rock was my thing. It probably won't be my son's thing. Big
right.
Thing. I know how to walk on and not be... just real fascistic about, you know, a genre or whatever. Like, oh, everybody should be listening to this. No, it doesn't matter. It mm-hmm. really doesn't. It's like, I'll listen to my Zeppelin. Like, the most exciting concert announcement I've seen this year is Joe Walsh, along with Bad Company, reuniting with Paul Rodgers at Red Rocks. I'm like,
yeah.
All right, that's my thing. I probably can't afford a ticket and won't be able to go, but that's the show I'd go to if I had the choice.
So anyway, but I just wanted to... sort of touch on that because I thought that I like the idea of the dude from the Hives playing with Angus Young, but they shouldn't call it AC/DC. They should
have to be like a super group or something.
It would have to be like Angus Young's like
Hive DC.
Yeah, it like Angus Young's Ball Breakers or something. I don't know.
Yeah, call it Ball Breakers. That'd be great.
Yeah,
I go see them.
Yeah, like... fuck it. But Pele Almquist with Angus Young, like that sounds badass.
I know, and I totally regret I didn't see the Hives last time they were in Denver. The only time they were in Denver.
I think they're the best band from that late 90s, early 2000s garage rock revival.
My favorite was actually the Helicopters.
Oh, I never listened to them.
They actually, I thought, sounded more commercial. It's funny, you listen to them, you think, well, this should be on the radio. This has a perfect, like, competent, clean sound. But nobody's playing rock on the radio, not new rock. Or unless they think Coldplay is rock. So... The Helicopters, I thought, were just extremely good and got no love. No love at all. Yeah, I'll play them for people. They'd be like, why wasn't this band huge? Mm-hmm. And they're a prime example of that. It's not shrill. You can play it on the radio. It's going to sound good, like I said. You know, definitely check out the Helicopters. They're my favorite band from that era. There's a lot of good ones, though. Glucifer, Turbo Negro.
Right.
Really tons of good bands. The Sewer Grooves.
But you would think the only one was the White Stripes.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the White Stripes got big. I'm like, okay, now everybody's going to listen to the Helicopters, right? Nope, didn't happen.
Yeah.
And you will listen to, there's at least two or two or three songs and you're wondering, why wasn't this like top 10? This could have brought rock and roll back or whatever. Yeah. It's like, no, people, kids don't listen to rock and roll anymore, so it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter how good it sounds.
Yeah. They don't care.
No.
But so speaking of not caring, that's a good segue right there into Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, sort of Destiny.
Yeah.
Directed by Yuen Woo Ping.
Yeah.
Written by John Fusco, who gave us the Forbidden Kingdom. Was it?
Yeah, Forbidden Kingdom.
Young Guns also 1 and 2.
He's been writing screenplays for quite a few decades.
Yes, he's been around a while.
Right.
I think he's, you know, he also did, what was it, Thunderheart.
Yeah.
And he's writing the upcoming Shaq movie adaptation of The Shaq, which will be the worst goddamn movie ever made.
What is The Shaq?
It's one of these religious tracts that sort of feeds the worst sides of people. Kind of like The Secret or something.
Oh, okay.
You know what I'm saying?
There's a book on my shelf called The Alchemist that somebody gave to me. I think this might fall in that genre.
Yeah, it's one of these things everybody goes, oh my gosh, have you read this? It changed my life. And you read it and you go, oh, this just kind of feeds people's fucked up selfish sides. You know?
Like, right. And I always say, well, you know, the book that changed my life was I, the Jury. You know?
I, the Jury.
Yeah, Mike Hammer, man. That was my... that was by... Who's the guy at Atlas Shrugged everybody loves? John Galt. Mine was Mike Hammer. Thanks. Who was Mike Hammer?
This is a sequel to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which John has told me many times is his favorite movie.
Yeah,
in 2000.
Boy.
John always goes, you know, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is just the pinnacle of the genre.
Yeah. You know what I like about you, Hunter? No sarcasm at all. Always up front with the facts and everything.
Yeah, yeah. I'm a straight shooter.
Yeah. You know, it's odd because Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, I still say is this kind of fluke that it's not going to happen again. Didn't really, as far as I'm concerned, didn't really pave the way for the genre in America at all.
No, in fact, it kind of created a false sense of what the genre is.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you watch Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it's really not representative of the martial arts genre at all. And
right.
If anything, it spawned a bunch of these sort of art house wuxia movies aimed at Western audiences, like Hero and I say aimed at Western audiences, I could be wrong, but we were getting so many of them, like that were all very similar, like lavish productions, like Curse of the Golden Flower. And
right, put it this way, they were really mainland movies, and mainland is not the same as Hong Kong or Taiwan.
No, totally different.
And and as I always point out, the Red China, the mainland China, did not really get a good look at the kung fu genre until, like, really the 90s.
Yeah.
I believe there were bootleg tapes circulating in the 80s and whatever when things started to open up a little bit.
Well,
but
mainland China was a commie hellhole for such a long
time.
It's still.
I mean, I got friends who live over there. They'll tell you quietly it still is. It's a police state.
Don't be fooled. Mainland China didn't have filmmakers really until like the 80s.
Like, yeah, I mean, you were allowed to make, I think, propaganda, and I'm guessing you were allowed to film opera.
Yeah, that was about it. And yeah. Like, you know, then you had their first graduating class from their, like, the film academy they opened from the people, and you had people like Chiang Kai-shek and, you know.
Right.
And there was, but it was all like artsy stuff that the communist government would just ban afterwards because it was too subversive. Like,
right.
There's this movie Zhang Yimou did called The Story of Chuju. Have you ever seen it?
No.
It's definitely like, I watched it in my Chinese film class, and it's definitely like a women's picture, but it is the most, it is the best in, like, it is one of the best attacks on, like, socialist communist states I've seen. Because it's just about this pregnant woman trying to get something done and just all the hoops she has to jump through to do anything. Right. And keeps getting deferred to other offices. And what's her name? The girl who was married to Zhang Yimou for a while, who's Gong Li.
Gong Li,
she,
right.
She, it's her pregnant, just like waddling around, like just miserable.
I remember when the film came out. I remember getting reviews, and I think I was curious about that stuff, but I was so into the Hong Kong stuff, which is way more pop cinema.
Yeah, totally.
You know, appealing. And I'm not just into the kung fu stuff. I'm super into the gangster films, but also the comedies, and I was enjoying some of the dramas. And,
yeah, like we talked about Stephen Chow last week. You know,
right, Stephen Chow. So it's not like we're just all okay. It's all Bruce Lee and Shaw Brothers, and that's it. There's all sorts of stuff made there. Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was sort of it was like Ang Lee's tribute to like the King Hu films. But
yeah, it does kind of. I mean, it does like the first Crouching Tiger does in a certain way feel a little. I can see the King Hu influences in it.
Oh yeah.
But that's as close to Hong Kong as it gets, and even King Hu made movies outside of Hong Kong as well.
Right. And the funny thing about Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it underperformed in mainland China. It was basically a flop there. It was actually a flop in Asia. And the reason being, it was shot in sync sound. They didn't do ADR on it. Chow Yun-fat is speaking Cantonese accent. Michelle Yeoh is speaking a Malaysian accent. Mm-hmm. And Zhang Ziyi, she is speaking in a mainland Chinese accent. Other actors are speaking Taiwanese. You know, it's just from where they're from. And of course, the audience is over there laughing at it.
Yeah, we don't notice it over here.
Right, we're not going to pick up on that.
But audiences over there are like, it's like, it'd be like having a person in a movie like that takes place in the South show up with going, "Oi, mate, what's going on?" Right. And somebody going, "Hey, we don't like your con here." And then somebody going like, "Hey, I'm from Southie."
Right.
You know, like, it's like, what the fuck?
or like a Western where everybody sounds like they're, like, some people sound like they're from California in the 1980s and other people sound like they're from New York in the 1970s. You just can't do it. And that's why Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon didn't do very well over there. Over here, because audiences already knew the name Yuen Woo Ping because of The Matrix. Mm-hmm. And the fight scenes really sold that first Matrix movie, more than the special effects, I think. And because Western audiences just hadn't seen that stuff very much. Kung Fu films kind of fell out of favor on TV, with the exception of Jackie Chan. They hadn't been seen in years. And so people see that, and they're impressed. And so they go see Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. They say Yuen Woo Ping directed the fight sequences. It certainly wasn't Ang Lee. It was Yuen Woo Ping's work. And that looked impressive to people. Like, I saw it with a packed house at a cinema, and everybody applauded after the fight scene between Michelle Yeoh and Zhang Ziyi. Mm-hmm. And by the way, her fight double, I think, in that movie was Max Zing, who is the main corrupt Wing Chun teacher in Ip Man 3. That was a very impressive fight with Donnie Yen in that. And so he's kind of graduated to being like an actor. People see that and it's unique and it's a hit and people went to see it. And I thought, okay, there's nothing wrong with the fact that this kung fu film, it's a wuxia film. I don't consider it a kung fu film.
It's wuxia.
And yeah, there's a distinction. And with subtitles and people went to see it, that's cool, but it's not very good. And I don't like it when people tell me that's the best they've ever, the best ever. Because
when people say it's the best ever, it's because it's the only one they've
it's
ever
only
seen.
When you've
or maybe they've seen that in Hero or House of Flying
Dragons. They've seen some of the really awful Jackie Chan movies of the 90s, like Super Cop, and think this, oh yeah, well, it's better than that, but so what? It's like, you've got to really know the genre to, you know. And of course I always go back, what does it matter? Nobody watches anything old anyway. But they announced this movie, Sword of Destiny, and they're based, okay, the original Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is based on a multi-volume novel series in Hong Kong.
Yeah, the Du Lu Wang.
Yeah, Du Lu Wang is it's how he's listed on the IMDb.
I can't remember what it's called, though. It's like some series,
Iron Crane series. And I mean, the only way you can read it here, I don't think they've even released an English translation. I believe they have only released the comic book adaptations, which actually are quite nice. If you like the Hong Kong comic book style, I think it's called Manhwa or something. They have a great use of color. Every page looks like a combination of Jack Kirby and Will Eisner and John Buscema, you know, but amazing color. I'm really surprised American companies didn't pick up on the airbrush color look, because they're fantastic looking. But that's about the only way you could read them in this country, as far as I know. They announced that they're doing this film in like 2013, and seriously, it's like 10 years too late.
I mean, These really seriously belated sequels, with the exception of something like Mad Max Fury Road.
Right.
Or like maybe, you know, financially you could argue Star Wars The Force Awakens or any of the Star Wars movies, really. I mean, but they never seem to work out. And something like this, it's straight to Netflix, which I don't think is a knock because that's just the way things are going.
Yeah, if things are going that way, you're going to see a lot of big stuff go straight to Netflix.
But the movie for a sequel to Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which I think is a good looking movie, like, but it's in terms of its production.
Yeah.
I think it's a very well produced movie. This movie has the sort of problems I see with a lot of martial arts movies I see these days. It's got too much of a reliance on CGI.
Yeah.
And first off, like, the movie's mercifully short, but it ends and you're like, that's it?
Right.
Well, this was it feels so tiny. It doesn't, like, at least the first one had this sort of, you know, like this big story, you know, like, this one,
it's not much scope. It doesn't have much scope.
And I thought I heard that it was kind of short and I was like, well, maybe it'll just be good and tight. But it's really not.
No, it feels longer than it is.
Yeah, it's...
It feels like it's 2.5 hours long, and it's only, like, barely 90 minutes. And it's stunning. They made a decision to shoot it in English.
Yeah, they did. And I loved... I did love how everybody had, like, that British accent.
Well, not everybody, because some people have, like, a kind of Northeast accent.
Yeah, that's... Well, yeah, no, not, like, not all of them, but some of them it was like... I am so and so known in. I was like, oh my! I was doing a little too cockney there, but I don't know. I was kind of laughing a little bit at some.
It's all over the place, and it's just weird. And Michelle Yeoh is speaking in that kind of broken. She may have gone to a British education school or whatever. I didn't bother to look it up, but I mean, she speaks decently. But when she's acting in English, she's a lot stiffer.
Yeah, she's very stiff in English.
It's really, and she's very way too stiff in this. And it's just like, and I don't know if that's a lack of confidence with the English language, which from what I can tell, she speaks very well. Or it's just the way she's being directed. My understanding is Yin Wu Ping is directed. He's credited as the director. A lot of the dialogue was actually handled by ghost directors, and I don't have their names or anything.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's like he was pretty much in charge of the action and the scope and, you know, all the non-dialogue portions.
Okay, like, speaking of action, did you think there were any memorable fights in this movie?
They were all kind of generic to me.
I mean, yeah, like, I thought that there was a moment during the ice lake fight. Mm-hmm. Where I was like, oh, this is getting kind of interesting.
That scene I liked because it was a little different.
Yeah, it was. It almost got there, but it was a little, it was just a little too dark, a little too, like, it wasn't quite there. But it was almost. I was like, that was the fight I kind of got, felt myself getting invested a little
bit. You know where it lost me? And I realized it because I took notice of that fight too. And I was like, there's too much slow motion. Mm-hmm. They're using slow motion for every move. And it's just not that necessary. It's like, we've seen Donnie Yen's double do a flip. I don't need to see his double do a flip in slow motion.
Jackie, like... shut up! exactly. And what was it? And also, there's something about the use of CG that makes the martial arts feel, like, kind of weightless and lacking impact.
Right. Well, nobody shows any power.
Yeah.
And although I like seeing Jason Scott Lee back on screen again,
I was like, Jason Scott Lee,
yeah, and it's
Dragon.
Like, although he looks, here's the thing, he looks massive, like he's just hitting the weight pile.
Yeah, I didn't recognize him. He's so right huge in this movie,
and quite frankly, he doesn't look that Chinese to me. And I hate to sound like I'm being racist or something, but no, he's like
hey,
Hawaiian.
I thought they all looked the same.
Yeah, he's like half Hawaiian, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you're right.
To me, he looks more like an islander than a Chinese guy. And there was one actress in there who, you know, I think she looks like she's half Italian or something. And she's speaking with that kind of generic mid-Atlantic accent. And it's very jarring. But yeah, it's like, when you have the CGI and you have it in the fight scenes, it takes away the power and tension, like, because it's like you're watching ballet. You're just watching people float.
Well,
like you're watching ballet on wires or something.
Exactly. And I read this piece by Chewie Hark in the Masters of Cinema Blu-ray for Dragon Inn.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about how, because he recently did a Dragon Inn movie, right? Another one.
Yeah, he did. I think he's done. He produced one remake or rehash, and then he with Donnie Yen, coincidentally. Then he, I think, directed a remake with Jet Li.
I think I think the one he talked about was Flying Swords of Dragon Gate. I think.
Yeah,
that's
the most recent one he did. It's unwatchable, but
yeah, and he was talking about how like hard it is to capture the feel of a King Hu movie, like Dragon Inn, and how with Flying Swords of Dragon Gate, he was trying to sort of, he was really going for it, and he felt he'd failed. And I was thinking, well, I saw the trailer for Flying Swords of Dragon Gate, and it looked like a CGI,
yeah,
shit fest, a lot of his other recent movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, you know, it's the physicality in the martial arts movie.
Right.
It's like, you know, I watched Dragon Inn, and it felt like I was watching an Eastern Sergio Leone Western.
King Hu didn't have a special effects crew. He depended on stuntmen like Sammo Hung to design these, and probably Yen Wuping's working on the film as far as we know. He had to rely on their efforts, their athleticism.
Yeah, because King Hu was a fat guy who smoked cigars.
He wasn't Liu Jialiang, where he was teaching the actors how to do the Hungar forms and stuff.
Yeah.
King Hu was a filmmaker. And you know, some lazier critics will tell you he was the only filmmaker who knew what he was doing.
Oh, that's bullshit.
In the 60s, which is so laughable. But although I like his films a great deal, I think that's crazy.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from people who just want to, they're just repeating cheap accepted lines.
Right.
James Ellroy did a presentation at the Alamo last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And he
by the way, how is your new friend, James?
He's doing good. James Ellroy is, he's talking about film noir. And he says, fuck all this shit you hear about film noir being about communism.
Oh, that's such horse shit.
And he does a jack off gesture going, wrong. You know, and he's like, or the atomic bomb, wrong. He goes, the only point of film noir is you're fucked.
Yeah, that's all it is life sucks, then you're dead.
Right, and yeah, that's what it is with Chinese cinema, is everybody wants to act like, oh, one director defined everything, and Bruce Lee brought technology to the industry, or filmmaking expert.
Yeah.
Or
these documentaries I see that claim that Asian cinema sucked, and then Bruce came along and saved it.
It's lazy.
And they always show like these clips from these wuxia movies, and they go, isn't it ridiculous? So then Bruce came along and saved the industry.
Right.
No.
God, it annoys me to no end. And when I got a hold of a friend's collection of old Hong Kong movie magazines, I was reading through them and kind of going, he had his organized chronologically where he could go through the decades and read it, and you could just see the attitudes and aspect of the film industry. And I'm like, so everything we've read in these English publications is wrong, because they just didn't see things the way you see it described in these silly documentaries like you mentioned.
Yeah.
That's not – Bruce Lee died. They didn't know what to do. No. They just went on and kept making
when
movies.
When Bruce Lee died, they didn't know what to do, so they made Bruceploitation films.
Yeah.
That's complete horseshit.
It's total horseshit. Bruceploitation films, as we've said on the show before, were made for the export market.
Yeah.
Export market wanted cheap revenge movies with not much cultural nuance. So Bruce Lee exploitation movies. You know, in Hong Kong, they were making movies like crazy. They were making all sorts of stuff. They were still making sword films. Chu Yun was directing these lavish Shaw Brothers wuxia spectacles till like the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So what are people talking about? That yeah. Bruce Lee killed that type of cinema? No, he didn't. They kept making them.
No,
and it's like
that those statements are, I've never seen anything but Bruce Lee movies. So
right,
it's kind of like that kid who says that the local scene died a few years ago when he stopped going to shows.
Right. Right. Exactly what it is. The genre started when I started watching them.
Exactly. Yeah. It's all like,
and
people
would never be so arrogant to tell you that. That's so silly.
No, and
yeah.
people base their film, what, like the way they look at films, around the way they experience them, it seems like. Right. And so it's, you know, so I impart it that way. They don't imagine that there's a context there. There's a bigger
no. Right, it's a bit bigger picture. And this sort of Destiny film, and the what I couldn't really figure out what they were trying to capture, because it's filmed in New Zealand predominantly. They used a lot of top tech people.
I was wondering why I kept thinking about Lord of the Rings.
Right. Well,
it.
You know what I was thinking of was the Sam Raimi Hercules and Xena shows.
Oh, wow.
That's what it reminded me of. It was like, and I was never a fan of those. And
I never watched them.
Yeah, I was always partial to the old, you know, the old Italian peplums from the 60s. And we'll probably do a peplum episode one of these days about Steve Reeves movies or something. Because I think those also get a bad rap, too. Because, yeah. Oh, they're all like gay fantasies. Or no, they're not. It's like those were what every kid was going to see instead of Star Wars. Like, you know, the Steve Reeves Hercules movies were like the Star Wars of the 50s. Like, mm-hmm. Everybody saw those damn things. You know, and so I never liked the Sam Raimi Hercules stuff, but I've seen enough of them to know the feel of them, of the walking around the sets in New Zealand. And that's what this was reminding me of. And everybody's got very modern accents.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I don't know why the hell they shot this in English. The only thing I can figure out is the Weinsteins were like, hey, could you make it the way I would have made Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon?
Yeah, because this is produced by the Weinsteins. Was it?
Who
I noticed.
Did not produce the first film.
No.
They turned it down. I think they were offered the film and they rejected it.
Yeah, and Harvey Weinstein. Yeah, and they. Like, Harvey Weinstein. The Weinsteins had that Dragon Dynasty label.
Yeah,
and they had Bay Logan blogging for them, and I noticed his name was in the producer credits for this.
Yeah, he worked on production. I'm not going to get into that stuff because there's some stories behind the scenes that are really they're unconfirmed. I'm just not going to talk about.
Oh, so okay, so you don't know for sure.
No, I don't. If I don't know for a fact, you know,
you don't want to tell stories, spread rumors.
Not at all. I mean, this isn't that type of show.
This is that's the responsible.
I'll spread rumors when somebody is dead. Sure. But also, what I can't confirm, it doesn't matter. I mean, all that really matters is what's the product on screen mm-hmm. that they've given me, and it's not good.
No, it's. I was hoping it would surprise me and be a tight, you know, just passable wuxia movie,
right?
Like maybe like a light version of House of Flying Daggers or something like that. I don't know,
right?
But it was it felt like nothing. Like it, there's no reason it should, after it was over, like I just forgot about it. I didn't care about anything while I was watching it. I don't care about the Green Destiny and this sword. Why is it special? Right. I don't know. Does the sword, do we hold the sword, John? Or does the sword hold us?
I know it's very,
it was
flat.
Jason Scott Lee's last line. I was like, I rolled my eyes.
And honestly, I'm not going to blame John Fusco for that.
No.
I don't think he's a bad writer.
No, I thought that, you know, if you want to see a much better movie he wrote than this, Forbidden Kingdom.
I enjoyed Forbidden
Kingdom. It's not bad at all. It's pretty good.
I accept it for what it is. It's a fun kids movie.
It is a kids movie that sort of tackles the genre in a fun, kid-friendly way.
Right. And John Fusco, I've heard, really cool guy, has studied martial arts, Chinese martial arts, for decades. And I was told by somebody who knows him, oh, you know that Netflix show Marco Polo?
Yeah, he did that.
Right. Well, John Fusco was working out with the stunt team.
Like, oh, really?
He keeps up his kung fu practice with the stunt team. And then how many screenwriters you know would do that?
John Milius.
No. John Milius is like asthmatic.
I know, I'm just kidding.
Fat.
I know. No, he's a big boy.
Yeah. It's like, but no, Fusco, you look at him, dude looks younger than he is and works out his kung fu with the stunt team and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, he kind of looks like Keanu Reeves.
Right. Just, you know, really enjoying his job. It's not him. It's not Yin Wu Ping, who is, I think, kind of just phoning this in because it reminds me of True Legend, a movie he did a few years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say, was that any good?
It's okay. It's nothing great. I liked it. I didn't love it. And it's almost like Yin Wu Ping's greatest hits. There's a drunken fighting scene. There's a Miracle Fighters type of fighting scene between sorcerers. There's all sorts of martial arts stuff that's all paying tribute to stuff he did years ago.
And I saw the... Like, I saw people praising it when it came out, but I was like, it was kind of the easily impressed crowd that loves, you know, that thinks Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon's God's gift to martial arts cinema.
Right.
But you know, I never checked it out because I was kind of suspicious of the praise it was getting.
Right. It's not, It's not great. It's enjoyable. I have it on my shelf. I didn't trade it in. It's got some good action.
Was that the movie David Carradine died jerking off while making?
No. He was making something in Thailand. I don't know if it was ever finished. He was like doing. People don't even realize how many movies that guy was making.
Yeah, no, he was like doing tons of movies in Asia. Like he was. Right. He was in Crank 2. That's the.
Yeah, he was like in films with Rip Torn that are just like, and you look on Amazon, if you look up David Carradine, you'll find there's all these David Carradine movies you didn't know existed.
Yeah,
they all got these kind of small DVD releases and stuff, and it was a lot of the same guys. Rip Torn would be in it with him, and it's strange. It's really weird. Or, you know, Mariel Hemingway would be in a movie with him. It's really, really, really bizarre, how much he was actually doing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at his credits, and it's like, you know, four movies in 2010, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 movies in 2009,
yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in 2008.
and a lot of people were, you know, a lot of these young, stupid writers who, you know, write blogs and everything were criticizing him for, like, blowing his... you know, the guys who write for Chud are like, oh, he's destroying the comeback he got from Kill Bill.
No, it's not! He's milking it!
No, he's making money. He's old, and he's not going to be around much longer. We didn't know he was going to go that quick. But
like, look at Kill Bill, okay? Like, I'm looking at his film credits. Like, before that, he was in one, maybe two movies a year. Well,
yeah.
With a few exceptions.
Right.
With some TV stuff. And then, like, after that, he's just cranking them out one after the other. That's called being in demand, you know?
Exactly. He's making money. He's not going to get offered, like, these major roles after Kill Bill just because he was in Tarantino.
What do you want him to do? Like, I mean, be, you know, Oscar-winning stuff? Like, fuck off. You know? Like, just go do work, and if something sticks, great. If not, move on to the next thing, you know?
Right. It's, I mean, look at the career boost Pam Grier got after Jackie Brown. It's not really there.
No, not at all.
And it's like, because I don't think she was ever comfortable.
If anybody blew a career boost from Tarantino, it was fucking John Travolta.
Yeah. John Travolta blew it because he kept going for the big stuff. The big important
stuff. Yeah, now lately, like, you know, stuff like From Paris with Love, Hello, that's the kind of movie he should be doing.
Yeah, he should have done that right after Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
But of course, that stuff didn't exist after Pulp Fiction.
Luc Besson's Cottage. Like making the sort of 80s action movies.
You know, eventually we're going to have to do an episode about how action cinema in the West, like, just kind of, yeah, like, had like a, I don't know, like, went down a black hole in the 90s.
Yeah.
And never really recovered. But then, like, Luc Besson's company was turning out these cheaply made action flicks out of Paris.
Yeah.
You know, and one of them, Taken, just does huge business over here. But. Yeah. But it was never meant to. It wasn't meant to be.
No, I remember hearing about it in England a lot before it came here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I guess, a pretty big hit over there.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, what's this Taken movie that I keep hearing about that Luc Besson did that all the critics hate because it's so racist?
You know,
whenever critics call something racist, I go, well, I have to see it now.
Yeah, you got to go see it.
It's getting my business because I got to check it out.
I have no interest in watching the movie with Pierce Brosnan and Owen Wilson. It just doesn't look exciting.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. I saw
that was the last This Is Racist film that got trashed a lot.
Oh, I said one right now is London Has Fallen. I think
that one's
getting a lot of hate.
I might go see that at the second run.
Yeah,
you know,
might be
hell?
Fun. Might
just
be fun
just to have a blast and laugh at the critics. But yeah, but how, like, the American action cinema doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah, it's all the CGI stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's all, like, you know, the Captain America Civil War.
Right, it's all superhero, it's pre-sold superhero stuff.
Well, and it's like, you know, I saw these GIFs where people see Spider-Man, they're like, oh my god, I'm like, how much Spider-Man have we had?
like, the last movie was 2 years ago, yourself.
Why are we so excited about Spider-Man being in a movie?
It's weird.
What are you looking at? You're looking at a guy in a suit. I don't know, but like, yeah, the action movies are like, they're cartoons basically,
right?
Today, you know, the physical action movies kind of, you know, it's rare that we get something like, you know, one reason Mad Max Fury Road was so exciting was even though it made liberal use of CGI, it felt physical.
Right.
When you watched it, you could tell they were wrecking cars and stuff, and so it was really exciting to see.
Well,
that.
It also created an atmosphere and feeling.
Yes.
And that is what sort of Destiny fails to do. It never creates a cohesive atmosphere. It's actually, I don't know if they did some weird color filter with it to make colorful.
Yes, they did. I knew something was off when at the beginning Michelle Yeoh gets out of her carriage and goes and looks over this cartoon mythical Chinese landscape. It looks like something out of Dragon Ball Z.
Right.
I was like, here we go. Like, I was like, this is one of those movies.
Yeah, it's not, it doesn't really pull together, and it's so artificial looking. And I didn't, I'm not a huge fan of the first one, but I never felt it looked artificial.
No, in fact, like, if you're talking about the Chewy Heart, talking about the King Who Feel, it at least had that in production. Everything felt physical. And this movie, like, you have this finale where Jason Scott Lee and Donnie Yen are bouncing off this rooftop, smash it through, and it just, I'm just like, there's no, it's, it has,
I felt nothing.
I was just like, yeah, this is a cartoon, you know?
Yeah. I felt like I was just watching two rubber balls or two toasters fight each other. I have no feeling for this.
And there really is something to be said for something on screen that has weight. And what if something's not there, your mind just kind of knows.
Yeah.
Like, you watch an old Bond movie and, you know, he does a crazy stunt, you kind of go, you know, and you watch Die Another Day, Halle Berry dives off the cliff and you feel nothing because you can tell, your mind just knows that's not her. That's not even a stunt woman. That's CG.
Right. It's CG. But if you watch even a silly Roger Moore movie, like Man with a Golden Gun, you still got a car going 100 feet in the air and twisting around with a stunt driver in it.
Like, you're going to get like him jumping boat, doing record boat jumps and Live and Let Die, you know?
Crazy, crazy stunts. You know, at least you're getting that. Or
like
Moonraker,
they fall out of the airplane and they're fighting in midair, you know?
It might be a crap film, but
yeah,
it's
Moonraker's,
like...
Moonraker's a piece of garbage, but...
Oh, it's horrible. You know? It's horrible, but it's like... But you're still... You've got something tangible. You've got something you can feel.
Yeah.
There's nothing in this movie you can feel. And the performances are so... Everybody seems like they're in a different movie.
Yeah.
You know, and Donnie Yen has his cool moments, but he still seems like he's from a different film.
Well, and even Jason Scott Lee's villain, he feels like something from Star Wars, you know?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You have these monks over, like, there was nothing like that in the first movie. The first movie, you had Chang Pei-Pei as that witch, but she felt like she was part of the scenery. This movie, like, you have these monks, and then you have these villains, like, wearing snake armor outfits and these pale-eyed sorceresses, and it felt like a fantasy. It crossed, like, way over into cartoon fantasy.
Yeah, it's like a Dungeons & Dragons movie.
Exactly. I was like, I don't feel like I'm hearing some ancient legend. I feel like I'm watching a Hollywood movie.
Yeah, and that's what you're watching.
It is a Hollywood movie.
It's like if Hollywood had decided to start making wuxia films.
This is
what they would make. Because, you know, you watch your Cecil B. DeMille Bible epics and you've got all these Hollywood actors speaking mid-Atlantic accents and the Malibu Hills to try to duplicate Egypt or whatever. It's the same thing. But it doesn't work because I think audiences today are too sophisticated to accept something... Okay, I'll put it this way, because I was thinking about this. It's like, why am I having such a problem getting into this with the English dialogue? But I have no problem watching those old Shaw Brothers movies with the Ted Thomas dubbing.
But still.
Right. And it's like, it's almost like when I was a kid watching those on Black Belt Theater, I kind of accepted that like those voices were the storyteller voices to explain this. To give me the dialogue. Chris Hilton's great voice. He's the lead voice in a lot of those movies. And you hear him in every film. And Ted Thomas is always the old villain. And it's like, I just know those voices so well. But my brain has accepted them as the storytellers, the interpreters. And then if I watch those movies in Mandarin with subtitles, I still enjoy them. Even though, by the way, they're dubbed in Mandarin. Everything was shot without sound. They're dubbed in Mandarin. They're poorly dubbed in their own language is always the old joke. I could still accept that, but this, where they're speaking the actual English with all this complete garble mixture blend of all these different English accents and nationalities, really, it just doesn't work. It just falls flat for me. It's like maybe if I showed it to my little kid, he might accept it. He would have no problem with it, probably.
Yeah.
But me, because I've seen so much, I'm so conditioned to certain types of ways of viewing this, I can't accept it. It's just like, I can't deal with this.
Right.
And it's just, it just lacks authenticity. I have heard from some people, or some viewpoints I was reading, there was like, it plays better if you watch the Mandarin dubbed version with subtitles.
Yeah, and I heard that some of that, a lot of that's, yeah, I heard some people complaining about that version of it too.
Really? Yeah. Well, and I wouldn't be surprised. It's simply not a really good movie, and it's not even a good movie, and it's disappointing because I love Yin Wu-Ping's work.
This guy is no slouch. Like, he's made a lot of great films.
Snake and the Eagle Shadow was my gateway to Jackie Chan. It's just like, I saw that in a theater in 1982. They actually did release Jackie Chan movies in American theaters and mainstream theaters and tried them out, and they made a little money. And I just thought it was great. And he made one of my all-time favorite kung fu films, which is Legend of a Fighter. Okay. And you can watch it on Hulu. Hulu offers it up. I don't know if it's English dubbed or subtitled. I'd recommend watching
it. I've never actually seen that one, so.
I would recommend watching it in Chinese with subtitles, Cantonese preferably. It's a terrific film. It is Yasuaki Karada is an old karate teacher, although he takes a job teaching the son of the son is actually, this is so complex because we're talking about Chinese cinema and everything goes back into their history.
Yes.
Liang Jia-Rin is Beardy, as some fans call him, is playing the young Ho Yin Jia. Ho Yin Jia, if you saw Bruce Lee's Fist of Fury, a.k.a. The Chinese Connection, which stopped in theaters in the 70s, Ho Yin Jia is the teacher who's poison, the Bruce Lee student.
He's the character Jet Li played in Fearless.
Right, Fearless. Jet Li plays him in Fearless. Ho Yin Jia, he was a real guy teaching that fighting method. And so he's playing Liang Jia-Rin is playing the young Ho Yin Jia, who gets a Japanese tutor, who is teaching him ethics and stuff. And, of course, he's picked on because his father, played by Cao Fei, another great talent of the old school, refuses to teach him how to fight because he thinks his son's too wimpy and he wants his son to learn ethics. I mean, there's various reasons. I need to watch the movie again. But he's not teaching his son his martial arts. Yasuaki Karada is actually spying on Ho Yin Jia's father to steal his techniques. Because it turns out Yasuaki Karada is really like he's a karate pioneer, a karate pioneer. So he wants to blend their family's techniques with his karate. And so he teaches the young Ho Yin Jia how to fight because he's picked on by bullies. It's a Yin Wu Ping movie. You always have that element. And so he learns how to fight and he beats up everybody and impresses his father. So his father starts teaching him the style because his son is so good because he's been learning from karate. And so Yasuaki Karada's character goes back and gives him they give each other like these jade pendants, or no, Ho Yin Jia gives his teacher a jade pendant and they wear it, and that's their gift, and they have their handshake and everything. So it's like the kind of father-son bonding thing with the teacher. Right. So it's before World War II. Suddenly there is a fighter, like Ho Yin Jia's beating every fighter in town, and people just need to watch the movie. I really shouldn't give away too much.
Well,
but
let's have that as a recommendation to watch.
Yeah, this is a recommendation. Watch Legend of a Fighter. It's on Hulu. The English dub version's not great. It's a little obnoxious. I would rather you check out the Chinese version with subtitles. It's a little easier to take, but it's a great film. What happens is, okay, Ho Yin Jia's beating every fighter, every challenger in the area. He's the champion of his father's school. Well, guess who's coming for the big challenge? There's a Japanese fighter. It's his old teacher.
Sick Karate. Men of Asia!
Right! And then, and yes, oh, and there's those references, because this was made about 9 or 10 years after Fist of Fury, so you still have those references. And so, here comes his old teacher, is actually the great evil karate challenger who's unbeatable. So, it's amazing. I just love the movie. And it actually makes me choke up a little. There's two movies that could make me cry: CJ7 and Legend of Fighter. So, and I mean, it's a great film, and it is on Hulu. You should definitely check it out on Hulu.
So if you have Hulu, watch that instead of Netflixing.
right.
I'm Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Sword of Destiny.
It's raw, man. It is a cheap film. It's an Ing Si Yuen seasonal films production from the late 70s, early 80s. It is not a big budget film at all, but it has a rawness and like heart, and it's tough, and yet it's also funny. and it just works. It's what I like about Yuen Woo-ping's films. And Johnny Ray Gasco had said to me, he was like, you know, that movie, that's when Yuen Woo-ping went next level.
Mm-hmm. that's but Johnny's thing. This is when you go next level.
And he's right. And I totally know what he means. And fans of Kung Fu cinema know what he means when he says that. It's like Legend of a Fighter is the next level for Yuen Woo-ping. And I don't think he ever got that good again. I know people like Iron Monkey. I really enjoyed
Iron Monkey. Fighters. Like, that's the one, probably that's the film of his over here, that and Drunken Master, that a lot of people have probably seen.
Those are the best known. But to me, Legend of a Fighter is next level. Those films are not.
Yeah. It's,
Legend of a Fighter is next level Yuen Woo-ping, and that's when he hit it. And that's a great film. This movie is a big step back. And, Yuen Woo-ping is so old. He's now making so much money probably from these type of productions.
Looks like he choreographed so many Hollywood movies for a while. I don't know if he still does.
He's probably living in a yacht, drinking champagne out of, diamond glasses. I don't know. But good for him. I'm glad he's making money and stuff. I hope this is not his last film. I hope this doesn't go out with this.
Well, because he did he did some work on Lethal Weapon 4, but then he did The Matrix, and then all of a sudden
he didn't work on Lethal Weapon 4. That was Yun Kuei.
Oh, really?
Corey Yun, who may have gone to the same opera school as him.
Okay, okay, I stand corrected. He didn't work on that.
Yeah, Yuen Woo-ping was brought over for The Matrix because the Wachowski, whatever they are these days.
The Wachowski.
Since they both trans.
Now they're both trans now.
They need to trans into better filmmakers.
Yes, that'd be good.
They saw Iron Monkey and Fist of Legend, and they loved them so much, they called the Shaw Brothers. They thought the Shaw Brothers were still making movies and were trying to find Yuen Woo-ping. And somebody at the Shaw Brothers said, oh, we can find Yuen Woo-ping for you. Let me connect you with people who can find him. And so that's how they hired him for The Matrix.
And after that, he did a ton of work on Hollywood movies. He did the Kill Bill movies. He did, he did Danny the Dog for Luc Besson.
I tell you what, Danny the Dog, or we call it Unleashed. That's actually some of his best work of the 21st century.
Yeah, that's a really good movie.
The action in that movie is really something. That was almost like Yuen Woo-ping was answering the Tony Jaa movie, Ung Bak.
Interesting.
Movie, when I saw that in a theater, I was kind of really surprised by how good the fights were, because I'd kind of given up on Jet Li making good movies. And I was like, whoa. And I was like, this is almost like he's giving an answer back to Ung Bak.
Speaking of Jet Li, what do you think of, and Wonja, what do you think of Fearless?
Fearless, I enjoy.
I love that movie.
I think it's a great one for him to retire on. I thought that was a really fine film. The Ronnie Yu, one of his best works.
Goes from. Freddy versus Jason, which is a Wuxia movie, at the end when Freddy and Jason are flying around firing.
It was totally intentional too.
Yeah,
but I really enjoy Fearless. I think Fearless is a terrific piece of work.
That's a great movie.
Yeah, it's really really good. And I kind of wish he'd just retired.
Didn't he?
I believe Yuen Woo-ping did the fights for that, because it's not Corey Yuen. Yuen Woo-ping, or Corey Yuen Kuei, as we would call him appropriately, he worked on the Transporter movies.
Yeah, he was the Transporter guy.
Yeah, he did the Transporter stuff, and then then it's like Jet Li either works with Corey Yuen Kuei, or he works with Yuen Woo-ping, and usually you get a better result when he works with Yuen Woo-ping.
Because he directed Jet Li also in a Tai Chi Master.
Yeah, which I don't like that much.
Okay, I never saw
that was
one.
That was a movie I enjoyed a lot more years ago, and then I watched it not long ago, and it just didn't hold up for me. I found that the Hong Kong action cinema of the 90s does not hold up.
Yeah. Well, the movies, the Hong Kong 90s action movies that I was told to go see that were great, none of them I've watched more than once.
It's okay. But my favorites from the 70s and 80s, Legend of a Fighter, which I babbled on about, I could watch those anytime.
Oh yeah, the Shaw Brothers stuff. I've watched many of those many times. The stuff from the 80s that I've seen. But the 90s stuff. There's something about the action in them. There's too much cutting. I don't know.
It became breakdowns, and it became Jet Li's very dependent on fight doubles. I don't think that's a big secret.
No, I don't think it is.
They have to do a lot of. They don't do master shots of the fights like the old Liu Chaoliang stuff. They do a lot of breakdowns.
Yeah, they would. They would montage these fight scenes, and you'd get a.
The fights are almost made in editing, and Sammo Hung actually kind of started that, and with his, he really mastered the art of cutting those fights with stuff like Warriors 2 and The Prodigal Son. And Prodigal Son's a great one.
Prodigal Son's a great film.
That's... beautiful movie. And that's one of my three favorites. It's Prodigal Son, it's Legend of a Fighter, and I think the third one, I always go back and forth on it, but I kind of say it's Martial Arts of Shaolin. But I also, no, actually Heroes of the East, I would actually rank above that. Mm. The Liu Zhaliang movie, also, which I saw on TV, it was Shaolin Challenges Ninja. No, it was Challenge of the Ninja when I saw it on TV.
Okay.
Now it's Heroes of the East, and it's on Netflix.
Heroes of the East rules.
That's a great one. That's probably my all-time favorite martial arts movie.
Yeah, we talked about that one on our Lau Kar Lung show, which
right.
was a while ago, and how that's one of my favorite ones of all time as well.
Right. I mean, there's some great Liu Zhaliang, Lau Kar Lung, whatever you want to call him.
Yeah. It's hard for me to break that.
36 Chamber of Shaolin, which I always called Master Killer, Mad Monkey Kung Fu. You can't lose with those movies. Eight Dragon Pole Fighter. It's just, and go back and listen to our show.
We did a whole show on those. So
yeah, you should go listen to it. It's terrific if you haven't heard it. Because I know we got a lot of new listeners and a lot of people into the kung fu flicks, but you know this type of movie, Michelle Yeoh so stiff and Donnie Yen never really. It's almost like he never really hit his potential.
Yeah, I see so many movies where it feels like Donnie Yen. I see some movies where he really blows my hair back, and yeah. I see some movies where it feels like he's mailing it in.
Yeah,
and this is one that he's. Mailing it in.
he's kind of just there.
Yeah,
and maybe he knew. Maybe he just knew it was up, or he was doing this as a favor. Or
yeah,
something.
And he's going to be in the next Star Wars movie, so look out for him joining the cast of the Raid as not doing any martial arts.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Like the guys from the Raid show up, and you go, "Oh shit, it's about to go down." And
then Chewbacca doing some sea lot.
Yeah, and then they're just like, "Oh, there's a monster. It's run away."
Oh man, that was so stupid. I was just like, "Yeah, Greg Way there, Abrams." Yeah, they remind me of what I always disliked about Hollywood films is post 70s is just they don't take advantage of anything.
No, they don't know what to do with that stuff.
It's like, if you watch The Big Brawl, you will see all these chances where they could have had Jackie Chan do all this amazing stuff, and they don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, but that's the way they think in Hollywood. It's like, no, you can't have an action scene. It's too soon. Like, there was always a story Jackie Chan told, and he said that, okay, I'm gonna go pick up the broomstick in this scene. All right, I'm gonna do a cartwheel, and then I'm gonna do a flip, and he's gonna do all his Peking opera stuff, and then pick up the broomstick. And then Robert Klaus is like, no, you're just gonna walk over and pick up the broomstick.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, nobody pays money to see me walk. He goes, in this one they will. And then Jackie Chan was like, well, fuck you. And then walks off to his trailer, and then he goes back because he's contractually bound to do this movie and respect the director, Robert Klaus, which is laughable.
Oh, yeah.
But that's sort of the philosophy and idea of, in Hollywood, it's just, let's just do the simplest thing. Let's not take advantage of all these opportunities for great action scenes.
Well, and if you do that, it might be weird. It might turn off this demographic.
Right. The audience, and when they were making Rush Hour, and by the way, I'm going to say something right now. I really don't like Jackie Chan these days.
Yeah.
I still love the old films, but I think he's a rotten human being. Rush Hour, like Brett Ratner was like, we got to keep the fight short. You can't do your long fighting stuff. And I'm like, and when I heard that, after I saw Rush Hour, I was like, where were the fights? There's no fights in this
movie. No, I can't think. None come to mind.
There's nothing you even remember him doing, you know? It's like people just remember him saying a racial slur, and that's it.
You, Michael Jackson. I'm Tita. You're
right. Tita. Boy, you talk forgettable movies of the 90s.
And then they had Roman Polanski in the third one.
Oh, God. Oh, I have a talkie story that I read.
Oh.
You want a talkie story?
Yeah, I want a talkie story.
All right, I'll give you a talkie story. This will be inside baseball. It may be edited out, so just a preface. But talkie.
This is the Greek businessman.
The Greek businessman, publisher, and playboy, professional playboy. He's also the captain of the Greek karate team.
Isn't he a judo champion or something?
He's a judo champ and a karate champ. He is currently the oldest judo champ, or he's like the
senior citizen judo
citizen judo champ of the world or something like that right now. And also a very inflammatory conservative baiting writer.
Yeah,
but,
somebody said, it's such a libertarian publication, but Jim Goad goes, Tacky comp targets neocons almost exclusively.
Yeah, he does. Taki, so in the late 60s, he's practicing his karate in his Swiss home. And Roman Polanski's visiting him and watching him like throw all these kicks on a punching bag and stuff. And Taki's doing all these high-flying karate kicks and everything. And supposedly Taki's like great at karate and stuff, Shotokan, all that stuff. And he throws a punch in Polanski's face, stopping short of an inch of his nose.
And Polanski trained with Bruce Lee, right?
Right, and Polanski's like all flipping out and goes, oh yeah, I'll fly in a man who could beat you up. And
I'll fly in a man who could beat you up.
Right. And
Sharon!
Like, right, and then so he flies in Bruce Lee. So Bruce meets Taki. And then they hang out and train for a couple of days. And then Taki and Bruce didn't really agree on footwork, you know, because Bruce was bringing in boxing and Western fencing and along with his Wing Chun and, you know, maybe a few of his like kickboxing techniques. I don't know if you'd really define it as that, but they didn't necessarily agree on footwork, but they did share training methods and everything.
Nice.
But it's not well known that Taki did meet Bruce Lee. I don't think he's ever really written about it.
Was this it wasn't in his book or anything?
No, I found some article. It might be in one of his books, but his books are out of print and ridiculously expensive. But
okay, well, I have nothing to declare, but I haven't read it yet.
Right, I've ordered it because it's the only one that's affordable. No. thanks Amazon Analytics. But he's got I found an article he had done with a newspaper where he was interviewed about his martial arts training, and he told that whole story about Polanski and Bruce Lee, and I was like, huh, that's pretty fascinating because there's a lot of people that met Bruce Lee and trained with him that you never hear about. Their experience. Mm-hmm. Harlan Ellison is a man who took lessons from Bruce Lee.
Was it James Garner?
James Garner is another one who
and,
I believe.
Was it Dana Gould was on his podcast saying he did the movie My Fellow Americans with James Garner, and he said James Garner told him stories about training with Bruce Lee and how like there was a black dude in the dojo who did something and Bruce just he didn't know what it was and Bruce looks at him and goes. That's one. That's your one. You know, like you get to do that once. And then the guy did it again, and Bruce, like, submitted him or something. He said, he was telling these stories about Bruce, like, disciplining his students.
Yeah, you hear so many different things that it's kind of become its own mythology.
Totally. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of myths surrounding Bruce, but the stuff that's not annoying is the celebrity stories. Those are always really cool.
Well, you know, one guy who wasn't impressed by him was Lee Marvin.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Marvin was like, hey,
Lee Marvin thought he was an ego. He thought he was an egomaniac.
Well, he was,
and he was. And I can say, even as someone who likes Bruce's work, he was an egomaniac.
Oh, totally.
You know? And but yeah, Lee Marvin was like, he wanted to be like Emperor of Taiwan or some nonsense. And I've heard that story from other people that was Bruce's thing, is he wanted to go back to Asia and basically rule Taiwan. It's just. Who knows what he was thinking in those days? But yeah, it's really funny all this stuff you hear now, and how legends get attached, and all these fake stories that the day Bruce Lee hit a machine and broke the world's record on the hardest punch.
Yeah, like he's Vegeta from from Dragon Ball Z or something.
Right, right.
Destroyed the machine.
And the triads didn't like him teaching kung fu.
Oh, the triads! So they had it, and you know the movie Dragon's responsible for some of that shit.
Oh yeah, it's made it worse.
Thanks, Jason Scott Lee.
It was bad before then, and it got worse after Dragon. It got way worse.
Yeah, that movie's full of ridiculous fictions.
And what's really awful is how the Bruce Lee estate goes along.
Oh, they totally do. They're just like, yeah, sure.
Plays up the Bruce superhero aspect 100%. I think that's just so wrong and ridiculous. And I don't think you should make any of these guys superhumans.
Did you know that Bruce invented MMA? Did you know that?
Jeez, good lord. You know, I would give that honor to Antonio Inoki for fighting Muhammad Ali in the ring in the 1970s. There's your first MMA match. It's intensively boring. They're strike one for MMA. It's just like, it's awful.
I tried getting into MMA a few years back, and I was just bored watching it. Like, real fighting, like, I don't know, that kind of fighting is just not fun to watch.
Well, to me, it's not a street fight. Right. I've seen street fights are over so quick. you blank, you miss them.
Oh, because one person's down, like, and right. fucked up so quickly. Because
there's no rules, there's no ref, it's not controlled.
You go to incapacitate the person as quickly as possible.
I've seen some MMA fights that are amazing, and some of the best fights
I've
ever seen.
The best MMA fights are the ones that are over as soon as they begin.
You know? Yeah, or they're just all action.
Yeah.
The problem with a lot of MMA is they have a lot of these fighters have a strategy of driving the opponent into the corner of the octagon and getting him into some sort of submission mold, and they're there for like a minute.
Well,
and then the ref.
I saw one guy who was like running down the clock and not fighting, and
there's a lot of that.
It was the worst fucking fight. I was getting so pissed watching it. I was like, why am I watching this?
And I've seen some tremendous fights in MMA. I've seen a lot of tremendous boxing matches. I've seen pro wrestling matches, worked pro wrestling matches that are incredible. But I've seen a lot of boring stuff from MMA. And I've seen boring stuff from boxing, but I swear I see it on a higher level on MMA because I think you've got a lot of guys. What you have is guys who are really good at grappling trying to punch and kick. And you have guys who try to punch and who are great at punching and kicking, or at least really good. None of them are boxing, where the money would really be, I think. But they're trying to grapple.
Well, isn't that what fucked up Ronda Rousey? She finally went up against somebody who could punch,
right,
or kick,
right. Well, this is what's so funny. Ronda Rousey beats Miesha Tate. Ronda Rousey gets beaten by Holly Holm, who basically outpunches and kicks her. Holly Holm's background was like karate, kickboxing, basically. And knocks her out with like a roundhouse kick or something. I have to go look at it again. And Ronda Rousey was just out of her element. She's not training with Judo Jean LaBelle anymore. Jean LaBelle won't talk about it to the press. Yeah. She's not training at his dojo or his sponsored dojo or whatever. And he's heartbroken about it from what I've heard. Mm. Probably shouldn't even be saying this stuff. But
rumor mill.
Yeah, Jean LaBelle won't talk to TMZ about this, but he's pretty heartbroken about it. And you could see the kind of the loss of character and skill in her ability since she left LaBelle's camp. So she's out there with Holly Holm, and that was a fascinating fight because she lost it. She was completely intimidated. She was blowing up like she was out of shape, which is funny because these women are in better shape than we'll ever be in.
Yeah, sure.
But she's blowing up. It's almost like a panic breath or something. Holly Holm's knocking the shit out of her, just beating the hell out of her. And so Holly Holm has this great victory, and she's real humble. She doesn't act like white trash or anything. She's really cool about being the champ. She goes against Miesha Tate a couple of weeks ago. Miesha Tate beats her. So Miesha Tate lost to Ronda Rousey. Ronda Rousey loses to Holly Holm. Holly Holm loses to Miesha Tate. It's like, hey, wait, you're telling me they're not invincible? Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, let that be a lesson.
It was one of those things where it was like Ronda Rousey was like being worshipped as this god, like,
and
for
it's
a minute.
Hype. All
and
it is,
and
is
it
hype.
Was total hype. And it was one of those things where I was like, yeah, you know, this is how quick your shelf life is as a fighter. It's
right. And I was laughing about it at the time, and I was like, oh, they'll probably bring some girl who's like a karate, taekwondo girl or something. She'll knock her right out, and that's exactly what happened.
Well, so we're about done with Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon.
We don't have a lot to say about it. It's disappointing.
What would you give it out of 10?
I give it like a 4.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah. I'm being kind. And I'm not, and let me add this again. I'm not dissing anybody who worked on this film.
Because
they may listen to the show.
No, well.
I'm dissing the producers and their certain aesthetic decisions. And I think
this movie has a lot of great talent working on it, you know.
Yeah.
It's, you know, a lot of these people working on the film, like, you know, even said we like the writer, John Fusco, you know.
Right. I
Forbidden
don't mind.
Kingdom, that's a better movie, you know.
He writes good pop movies.
Yeah.
Scripts.
The director's great, you know, you have lots of great talent in front of the camera and behind it, but, you know, it's also a Hollywood product, and Hollywood product typically doesn't get this kind of stuff.
And I think there was a list of certain things that had to be done by the Weinsteins that they had to follow, and that's why you got the results you have.
Sure.
And also, this film was kind of a testing thing for the whole Netflix simultaneous big screen debut, and what happened was all the theater chains rejected this film.
They did. I don't think it hardly played anywhere.
And there was a bitterness to it. It played like, I think I checked on Wikipedia before we recorded, 15 IMAX theaters across the country. Mm. It ran for like a week, and that's not a lot. And it's just like all the major theater chains didn't want to deal with it because they don't like Netflix's deal of premiering the same day it launches on the stream.
Yeah, they're going to be resistant to any change in the business model for sure.
Right.
Because it doesn't favor them. And I would prefer going to see a movie in a theater any day.
Right.
Because it, like, I'm kind of on the same page as like Bret Easton Ellis, where he says that there's just something about that experience that
it
starts
true.
And stops without you, you know.
It
the,
is.
The
it's
culture
true.
Of convenience around streaming, you know, I love my, you know, I have Netflix, obviously. I love having all kinds of movies at my fingertips.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's nice to have a place where movies, you know, where the movie is, you know, you're in a dark room with it and that's it. You know, you can't.
Well, like, on Saturday I saw James Ellroy presented Experiment in Terror. And
you guys had a little chat, didn't you?
Yeah, I talked to James a lot. He came up to me and started talking to me. Like he recognized me from other screenings.
Because you go to them a lot. I see you posting about him a lot.
Oh, yeah. I've attended every single one. And it's worth it just for his introduction. But he finally showed two movies I had never seen. I think I saw Experiment in Terror when I was a little kid on television, but it didn't really visually affect me the way it did seeing it in a theater, because it's an amazing experience. And you wonder why Blake Edwards didn't make more of these noir thrillers.
Yeah, because I've always heard that the Blake Edwards, sort of his movies like that were really good.
Man, it's fantastic.
And that, like, his comedies are kind of overrated.
They are. Well, I like the Pink Panther movies a lot, but I love those. But Experiment in Terror was just amazing to see on the big screen. There's nothing like it. Bernard Herrmann's score is, like, perfect. No, I'm sorry. Henry Mancini. Mancini's score is, like, a great thriller score. And, I mean, it's just, like, he's got a certain theme for the bad guy, the villain, played by Ross Martin, whenever he shows up. It's great. There's nothing like that in movies today. Characters don't have their individual themes created by the composer.
Yeah, they. I find that I notice film scores hardly ever.
Mancini, days. It's funny because if you go and let's say you pick up some Mancini vinyl at Half Price Books, where your haunt is,
it's cheap.
Right, it's like you pick up some Mancini vinyl. It could be any movie, and it's an amazing score.
Yeah, I've been buying a lot of soundtrack vinyl.
Yeah, Henry Mancini's really good. It's like I mean, I've always been like Ennio Morricone, Riz Ardolani, you know, the Italian guys. I'm like, you know, Henry Mancini's got some fantastic scores. I need to get more of them.
I've been listening to a lot of the Nino Rota scores lately.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. There's a lot of good stuff with that. Bernard Herrmann's the other one. I've had Bernard Herrmann on the brain a lot, too. That's why I misidentified him earlier. But it's like his scores are terrific. It's just there's a lot of that is just missing, that certain personality and everything. But when I saw Experiment Terror in the theater, I was just like, this is great. And they had a new digital print from Columbia. Just beautiful.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, so if this plays Alamo Drafthouse near you, I would say go.
Yes.
And that goes for anybody listening. But yeah, fantastic stuff. But that experience, seeing it on the big screen, it wouldn't have affected me that way on TV at all.
No, I don't think any movie affects me on TV the way it does in the theater. Well, you know, not all movies are created equal. But
no,
you know,
no, not at all.
But you know what I mean. Like, you know, I see some movies and I kind of go, you know, I probably would have liked that more on the big screen.
Right. Oh, I've had that happen with a lot of films. That I'll see on television. And some movies I enjoy more on video. One example is Danny Boyle's Trainspotting.
Oh. Huh.
I liked it more on video. I didn't enjoy it in the theater.
Another movie that's getting a belated sequel.
Yeah, that's true. And will anybody care? I don't think so. You know. Did you rate our Sword of Destiny? Your rating?
Oh, I'd give it like a 4, maybe a 5 if I'm feeling generous. It's
nice.
I'm on the same page as you. Like, it just didn't affect me at all. Like,
right.
It added nothing to my life.
It lacks a compelling, like, a draw. Like, it doesn't draw you in at all.
No, it's just, I mean, for a second, like, at the beginning when she smashes out of the cart, and I was like, okay, here we go. And then I kind of went,
Yeah.
No, thanks.
No, it's just like, it just feels like something I've seen 1,000 times before.
Yeah, no, exactly. It is.
You know, it reminds me in a way of those Hong Kong TV shows.
TV.
They have these Wuxia serials that are shot on, like, video.
Didn't the Shaw Brothers run TVB, or
was that yeah, they did. They ran it, and a lot of stuff was produced there, and there would be all these dramas, and they're fun to watch, but the action scenes are generic, because they're all shot this way, with lots of cutting and everything, and it's on video, so it's like watching Doctor Who with Kung Fu, so, you know, it's a little weird watching that type of action on video. But I've always enjoyed those when I sit down and look at them. It's similar to the Telemundos, telenovelas, or whatever they are, with the, you know, the real beautiful scenery of Mexico. Although I think some of them are actually filmed in L.A., which is weird to me.
Hmm.
You know, it's like, but yeah, it's like they're TV dramas. They have that generic, that kind of generic look, and this reminded me of that.
Yeah, it just, it didn't have anything about, like, even Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it had a unique look and feel, even though yeah. it's, you know, it's, even though we've been kind of critical of it, I think it's great compared to this movie.
Yeah, I kind of respected it a lot more.
Yeah.
I think it's also because Ang Lee went over and made the most pretentious Hulk movie possible.
Oh, totally. Totally. I remember when the Hulk came out and everybody was just watched it, just, what the fuck was that?
Right. You know? And I know some people who praised it just because it was such a big F you. Yeah. Everybody wanted to see a good superhero movie.
A lot of, like, my kind of contrarian friends were praising it because they,
right.
they praised
all
the
my contrarian
style.
Friends loved it, thought it was the best.
They were praising its editing style and, you know, and, just the and all that, but I was like, but it's such a talky, dull movie, and it just has hardly any fun to speak of.
Right, know? And Nick Nolte's crazy ass speech before he becomes the Absorbing Man.
Yeah,
these men with their guns and their medals,
and then the Hulk's like flying around like into like it looks like he's fighting Zeus. It's like it's this arty final battle that was
yeah,
just goofy.
It's something that, you know, we talk about how Hollywood doesn't understand physicality,
mm-hmm.
and they have never understood this. You do not have a physically strong or physically skilled hero fight some sort of psychedelic, undefinable mass villain. You know, you don't have them fight the Blob. You have them fight something of similar, equal, or better skill. That's just the rule of physicality in
yeah.
action. This is why The Rock is not a major action superstar today. It is. It's like, I mean, he stars in, I think he's great.
Yeah.
He stars in movies. He's got great screen presence. They don't know how to create villains for him.
No.
Because he's so much bigger than everybody else in Hollywood.
Everybody, most actors are compact little tiny people.
Yeah, it's just like, he's so towering that they always hire like Christopher Walken to be the villain. It's like, well, we know he can
hey,
stomp
Mr. Bond.
Him like a, right. It's like, you know, he can just
Whoa.
Stomp him like a bug.
Yes.
It's Whoa. Like, you gotta have a real opponent for him. And I mean, I'm laughing my head off and they got Vin Diesel beating up The Rock in these Fast
oh,
and Furious.
Oh my God. Oh,
it's
I like, know. Vin Diesel's a midget. Yeah.
Yeah. How many of those crates do you have to stand on to yeah. Reach The Rock's jaw with that punch?
Don't pan down too much. You'll see platform shoes.
He's on wires yeah. to measure up to him to throw any move on. It's just, it's ridiculous.
Well, let's go ahead and sign out.
All right.
Visit us at midnightmoviecowboys@midnightmoviecowboys.com. Send us an email, midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Look us up on Facebook, join our group, get a discussion going. Stuart will be back next week once he's done preying on tourists in the outback.
Right.
And
mugging kangaroos.
Yeah, he does
and
that.
Eating their hearts.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't even cook them.
Doesn't call them Matilda.
Nope. But yeah, do you have anything you need to plug, John?
Be sure to check us out on phantomsway.com.
Yep. Phantomsway.com, yes,
sort
thank
of
you.
Our co-op distribution site. They've been really great, really generous, finding, you know, introducing us to a lot of new listeners. Appreciate their work, and there's a lot of cool articles up there. Do not miss it. It's worth checking in every day. Something new is posted. So, yeah, check them out. I am going to be co-hosting a film series at the Alamo Drafthouse in a couple of months.
Ooh,
I will have more information. We're kind of getting our tryout in May. We're going to be presenting John Woo's The Killer. I will have more details. If there's anybody who listens locally that wants to come and check it out, this
okay.
will be a,
well,
this will be a chance.
Keep us posted.
Yes.
That's exciting. So, anyway... if you like our show, please go subscribe on iTunes, leave us a review. A rating and review would be nice. That would help bump us up a bit.
Yeah.
If you want to help and, you know, you don't want to donate or anything like that. So, anyway.
Save the idiots and racist comments for, you know, blogs.
Yes.
Nobody read. They'll put on the iTunes review.
Yeah, yeah. No, we just make fun of them on our page.
Exactly. We're actually going to make an ad that's just nothing but Leslie reading the negative.
Yeah, news. just the things people said about us.
It's in the planning stages.
Yep. All right. Well, if that's all, adios.
And mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys. For more information, go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com. For feedback, comments, or show suggestions, go to midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like what you hear? Head on over to iTunes and leave us a review. Hear us on Stitcher Radio. Head over to stitcher.com and download the app. Want to help the show out? Head on over to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Find us on Twitter at MMCowboys. Like us on Facebook. Head over to facebook.com. Type in Midnight Movie Cowboys. Hit the like button over there. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Go to www.midnightmoviecowboys.com and find the links from there on the right-hand side. Thanks for listening. See you all next week.